Appreciate being here. It's I've often admired the Berkman Center's work, and I've come to a bunch of different things that have happened here. So it's a pleasure to sort of take part more directly in what goes on here. I was invited here to speak about the internet and the music industry, which is a fairly narrow topic. It's the idea of sort of encapsulating that in anything less than a 7-volume treatise is sort of crazy. But I guess there are some things that I'd like to sort of talk about at the beginning. One of the things, as was mentioned, I was in a band. I actually passed a bar exam in the early 80s, and I worked for a white-collar crime firm for a short period of time, and sort of had a midlife crisis in my 20s, and just I had a deja vu of myself waking up as a unhappy, fat, 60-year-old lawyer with a legacy of people I couldn't stand. So I bailed on that law practice after one particularly heinous victory for a client who should have gone to jail. And I started a rock band, and I was in a rock band for about 12 years. My parents were thrilled with that decision, of course, but much that has happened in my life has been as a result of sort of doing music. And we had several releases on independent record labels in Boston. We had a major label deal on Epic. Played all over the country, played with some really great artists, Sinead O'Connor and Brian Ferry and Psychedelic Furs and Black Uhuru and Robin Hitchcock and the Pixies, and had a great time. And used to love the van. You know, the van was like the portal to the world. And but after about 10 years, the van got a little, didn't have the same luster that it had at the beginning. But nonetheless, I know the drive that an artist has to try to reach his or her audience. And in many ways, it's just as hard as it's ever been to make anybody care about your music, but in some ways it's never been easier. And so I think there's been obviously you guys know, a radical transformation in the way that people consume music, find out about artists. There's a lot of noise now, but I think in terms of if you're really, really good and you're really industrious and you work the web, things can happen in very unpredictable ways, and in many ways that has never been easier. One is an inherent basic contradiction in the music industry. It's a kind of a yin-yang thing. I talk about this in my classes at Northeastern. The very, I think, contentious bedfellows, this idea of sort of inspiration and exploitation. You know, the reason that somebody plays a guitar or writes a song or sings is not necessarily directly connected to one's desire to get paid. And I often tell my clients, if you're trying to make a lot of money with your guitar, you might want to reconsider your priorities. Not to say that you can't, that if your work isn't successful, that you shouldn't share in that success. But I think primarily looking at your guitar as a money-making vehicle it's a long shot. And as my dad, God rest his soul, who was a CPA, when I quit the law practice to start my band, he did his utmost to sort of dope slap me back to reality. He said, you know, Dave, statistically speaking, you're doomed. And I was like, well, you know, thanks, Dad. but I'm not approaching this like a CPA or a statistician. I have to conquer the world. I wanted to be Shakespeare. I wanted to just be in the Shakespeare Club. I wanted to be great, timeless, and create stuff that would always sound great. And I figured that if I followed my heart and I had talent, that my wallet would follow. Wasn't necessarily the case, but I had great success and I have no regrets about what happened. But there is this sort of fundamental antagonism, I think, between music and the industry, you know, and it's a kind of a yin-yang kind of a thing. And I sort of liken it to, if each is like a hemisphere, you have music, which is a hemisphere, and you have the industry, which is a hemisphere. And if all you have is great music, you can't really go bowling with a hemisphere. It'll skid or wobble and flop, and it won't really get any movement. And similarly, if you have great business but no music, no art, you can have the most fantastic business team in the world, but without the goods, it's not going to fly. So I liken this sort of the music business to this sort of a joining of two hemispheres, where there's maybe a slight permeable membrane where there can be some communication between the art and getting paid. But I think it's rather than blending it all together where you have the art being constantly informed by the business, I think there can be a kind of a contamination there. And so if you have all your impulses blended together into this sphere, I think it does a disservice to the art, and I think it muddles the whole thing. So I think my motto to my students and to my clients, who I work with a lot of musicians, is this yin-yang model, which is be great, get paid. Be great, get paid. And you join those together and hope that that can work. And so, but I think greatness has to come first. You have to have the goods first. And then, you know, putting a barcode on your dreams is a very, you know, difficult proposition. But I think that it's a very, it's a very tricky intersection, inspiration and exploitation. And I sort of deal with that all the time, being inspired and being great, and then trying to get paid and reach an audience and hopefully share in the financial success of that. So I have had my law practice for about 13 years. And one of the first things I always ask bands is, what are your goals? What are you trying to achieve? And it used to be almost everyone or every band would say, one person would say, to get a label deal. And I don't know that's a goal. I think it may be a means to achieve a goal. I think a goal is more you want to reach your audience. And then I think once you have reached your audience, you can leverage that brain acreage for further connections with your audience. And however that is achieved, I think these days getting a label deal is sort of akin to purchasing a ticket for the Titanic. You may, you know, get a nice seat on the top deck and, you know, congratulations, and it goes down. So I think, you know, in many ways, I think music still has the same allure that it had. I was a college DJ at Boston College Radio, and I still get, you know, the hair on the back of my neck will stand up when I hear something in the car. I can't get out of the car. I'll drive home. I've got three kids, and my wife's inside waiting for me, and I'm just sitting there because I have to hear who this is. So it still has the same attraction to me, and I still love it just as much. But the way that I receive it, or the way people receive it has changed, obviously. And I liken the, you know, music is like, say, travel. People like to travel, but no longer are they going to be getting on a horse and buggy to do that. So I think that music still has the same fantastic appeal that it's always had, but the intermediaries, obviously, are not the same. And so it isn't as if music is going to lose its importance. It may be culturally, there's more more entertainment content and more things vying for that cultural space that music once had, but I still think that music has it's never let me down, and it's the same as it is, you know, as it has always been. So, but the intermediaries obviously have changed, and with technology having changed everything, the way that music is delivered and consumed obviously has to change. And, you know, once upon a time, obviously, and you guys know this, you had to get into a car and go to a place and get a thing. I want to get a thing and bring the thing home, and I'll let you borrow my thing. And music was embodied in these material objects. And in fact, copyright law is articulated in forms of, in terms of material objects. And now this is utterly transformed, completely and utterly transformed. And so now you no longer have any constraints of time or space. You don't need to manufacture, you don't need to ship, you don't need shelf space, there are no returns, there are no dangers of overproduction or of not being able to serve a need fast enough. It's incredibly convenient and incredibly just transformed. And so record labels are trying to figure out what to do, record stores are trying to figure out whether they can survive or not, and it's just a phenomenal space right now. And I think it's incumbent upon us, lawyers, academics, to try to think of a way to leverage the capacity of this technology in a way that's not going to do short shrift to the needs of creators to get paid and to the ability of people to consume things and to access these works. And so how is that balance going to be achieved? And it's not, I think, you know, traditionally copyright law has focused on this idea of control. And you give owners the exclusive right to control how their works are disseminated or consumed, and the idea of the exclusive right to distribute or to perform or to display, and that has that notion of securing, you know, in the copyright clause, the notion of securing for the progress of arts and sciences to secure an author's for a limited time exclusive control over their works, that I think needs to be reexamined. And obviously a lot of the work that's been happening here at Berkman and with Terry Fisher and all the people here has been, I think, very illuminating in sort of painting a picture about where this can go. But I think I I agree that the emphasis of copyright law, the principles of copyright law need to change. And it can no longer be about control, because that doesn't really serve the purpose of the copyright clause of the Constitution, which is to promote the progress of arts, the progress of science and the useful arts. And so the idea of trying to control what people can do with files that are now liberated from containers is, it's a long-held tradition, but I think ultimately it's going to be a bankrupt tradition or a bankrupt concept moving forward. So rather than trying to figure out how people are, how you're going to control things, I think you have to, the system has to change to this idea of perhaps tracking and getting paid. And so I think rather than having, and I think if you have a comprehensive system that does allow for tracking of works and compensation for works, then I think that is where the future points. And obviously the entertainment space right now is in utter upheaval. I mean, just a snapshot of some of the things that are happening this week. You have the new Representative Boucher and Doolittle introducing their Freedom and Innovation Revitalization U.S. Entrepreneurship Act, Fair Use Act, where they're trying to undo some of the draconian aspects of the DMCA and trying to actually codify some of the principles in the Betamax case, especially in the wake of the Grokster decision, where now you have this idea of intent. And what does that do? You know, you're opening up this 10-year at least period of litigation where people aren't going to know what's involved. Is this fair? Is this technology going to subject me to a lawsuit? You have, you know, the idea of the next man or woman in her garage with the next great thing being unable to unveil this technology because they can't get financing because nobody wants to fund a lawsuit. Nobody wants to get slapped with some kind of with liability for some technology that could be incredibly useful. You also have the RIAA and the MPAA. They are targeting colleges once again. There's now thousands of new letters going out, and they're going to be initiating thousands of new lawsuits on college students who are engaging in peer-to-peer file sharing. And I think it's not too much of a stretch to say that suing your customers is not a long-term business model. And so I think rather than trying to litigate and to sort of slap down people who love this music, try to figure out how you can leverage this customer experience, monetize it, let it happen, and let them share. I mean, part of the problem when I was in a band was making anybody care about my band or know about my band. And here you have a situation where people are caring and having this enthusiasm. And so rather than trying to stop that, you've actually got them, they care about what you're doing. They like this. And so how do we encourage that? And how do we create a situation where you can monetize the system and enable that customer enthusiasm to take hold? And I think that one of the paradigms that that I have focused on is one that Terry Fisher talked about in his book, Promises to Keep, which is the idea of, and actually there are other examples as well, but you have a few years ago, the EFF published a white paper on voluntary collective licensing, where everybody could pool their works into this voluntary system for compensation to be determined by the owner, and then people could trade these works based upon voluntary collective licensing. The problem with that, I think it does point to a very promising idea, but the problem with that is it's not, you have to, it's voluntary, so you have to, I mean, you have to get people to submit their content. And if people don't want to submit their content, then you've got a very small repository of works to begin with. And then also you're asking people to pay to participate. And I think the cat's out of the bag in terms of getting people to pay for anything. I think music seems to be free, whether it should be free or not. You know, it's like when I put bread into my toaster and hit the toaster button, it comes out toast. And when I hit when I want to get a file, I hit a button on my computer and it works. So I think a lot of my students at Northeastern have a hard, I mean, they understand that it's quote unquote wrong or unethical, but they have a hard time squaring that with the fact that it seems to be like a core functionality of the computer that I have. So I think that rather than trying to legislate ethics or litigate ethics, you need some kind of a different model. So I was struck with Terry Fisher's idea about having some kind of a tax on media and devices that would raise a revenue pool, and then you could compensate people from that revenue pool. And there actually, as I'm sure many of you know, the Audio Home Recording Act, which was passed in the early 90s, did precisely that. It actually it had a levy on digital audio recording technology, which raised a fund. And this fund was then used to pay record companies, featured artists, songwriters, and publishers based on popular performed works on Billboard charts or on performance rights organization charts. So the idea of taxing this technology and then allocating revenue based upon popular works has already been in place. I think the Audio Home Recording Act was almost doomed out of the gate because it fell victim to very narrow drafting. One of the techniques of copyright drafting, unfortunately, is an attempt to maintain the status quo while allowing something new to sort of come to the table. And so it's very difficult to sort of draft copyright legislation in a transparent, large way because the stakeholders don't want their hegemony to be challenged. And so you have incredibly obtuse statutory language, and that happened with the Audio Home Recording Act. You had very specific language that was a snapshot of technology in 1992, which became irrelevant in 1994 because one of the problems was that an audio recording device didn't include computers. And so if you don't include computers in this equation, it's really not going to have much effectiveness moving forward. So, but there was, at least there is this effort or this historical precedent that talks about taxing technology and devices to come up with a revenue pool. There's also the small rights licensing model, which was which has been demonstrated by ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC, where it's impossible for owners of copyrights to individually license the works that are going to be consumed to all the different places that are going to be performing music. So all the publishers pool their rights, and then these intermediary organizations act as a one-stop shop for organizations that are going to be performing music. So so those two concepts together, taxing technology and coming up with a small rights licensing regime, I think makes sense. And historically also, Congress has, when needed, has responded to bottlenecks in the industry. The idea of compulsory mechanical licenses, you know, in the early 20th century, when publishers were not allowing their songs to be licensed on the then current technology of piano rolls, Congress came in and said, okay, once the publisher has allowed their composition to be licensed, it becomes then subject to compulsory license. And then any piano roll manufacturer can participate in this new technology. So those kinds of precedents do exist. And one of the things I'm undertaking at Northeastern is I'm doing a case study of the Napster era. And one of the things that I want to do is explore this idea of an alternative compensation system based upon researching in the Napster era. And one of the things I'm suggesting is that this alternative compensation system be funded by levying a 3% surcharge on anything that enables internet functionality. I call it the iLevy. So it would be software, hardware, services, and anything essentially that is goods, hardware, software, and services which enable internet functionality. And what I want to do is in the years from 1999 to 2002, see how much money would have been raised by this iLevy. It's, I'm sure, going to be astronomically huge. And then go to the NAFTA databases and see what Metallica would have made, or what Dr. Dre would have made, or Eminem would have made, or Wilco would have made, had this regime been in place. I also want to do an algorithm of the VNU Billboard family of charts to come up with kind of a bond rating to say that, you know, so if your works are platinum, or if you are participating in sort of a higher, more popular category, then every time that work is traded in the system, you're participating at a higher revenue pool or a higher royalty rate than a starting band. So the idea is a weighted formula whereby the most popularly performed and popularly traded files would participate in this more lucrative royalty category. And the idea is to then take this case study of Napster and Metallica in the Napster era and present this alternative compensation system with some real numbers and advocate its adoption by the entertainment industry. Because I think that the idea of wresting control from copyright holders is going to be, as is proven, a knockdown, drag-out fight. But I think if we can demonstrate the efficacy of this system by saying, here's how much money would have been raised, here's what you would have made, here's what a bond rating system, so it'll allow the more popular works to make more money, because that's been one of the complaints by some of the majors to the iTunes system. Why shouldn't Gnarls Barkley make more from an Apple download, say, than Joe Blow and the Tone Deafs, some band you don't know? So this way you can sort of accommodate or take into consideration that objection by the content industry that the more popular works will be traded at a higher revenue category, and still leverage this capacity that the internet has and digital technology affords, and present this with some hard numbers to present this alternative compensation system, and then begin to advocate for its adoption here in the United States. So, I don't know if this is a good point to take a break or to open things up to the floor. Or...
Right, yeah, no, this is definitely a good time to take questions. Before you ask a question, could you introduce yourself? And maybe if you're part of the law school or wherever you're from, that would be perfect. So, yeah, we can open it up to questions.
Okay. Yes.
Sebastian Diaz, Berkman staff. I just have a question. In the age of, like, spam and automation and the ability to produce results that aren't necessarily the correct results, how does the bond rating system incorporate the idea of corruption and being able for a more tech-savvy band to, say, boost their numbers?
Great question, and that's something that I, frankly, have recognized to be an issue. You have sort of auto-bots or auto-pinging where you have people sort of saying, wow, look how popular I am. You have a program that just sends the file from computer to computer, and obviously you have some sort of false results. And so there would need to be, I'm not a tech guy, but I think it's absolutely, that's a square one question. How do you avoid, the system has to be really effective and has to guard against sort of auto-pinging and bands just, artificially raising their bond rating. But I think that's something that actually has to be addressed. As to what the technology would be, I would defer to people who actually, program, but I think you're dead on right, that this system, in order to work, has to be robust against hacks of that nature. Because I think one of the things that I like about this idea, though, is that if there is this iLevy at the door, where everybody pays the iLevy once you buy a computer, or when you have your ISP fees, or you get your Ethernet card, whatever it is, if you pay your levy at the door, there's no reason to hack around it in terms of getting free music, because all the access points will have paid their fee to get in the system in the beginning. So, but you're totally right. There'll still be the desire to corrupt the system by creating false popularity by these devices. So that's something that has to be addressed, absolutely. How it would be done, I'd leave it to someone who could figure that out, but I mean, it's absolutely a core question.
I'm Matt Lovell. I'm with the clinical program here at the Berkman Center. I have a couple of questions, but one is, to what extent, I'm not really familiar with the Audio Home Recording Act kind of negotiating legislative history, but did the kind of technology, the technology manufacturers, who did CD players and DAT decks and stuff like that, did they object to that kind of framework? And in the framework that you're proposing, is there likely to be a blowback from the technology manufacturers who would say, we don't want to pass through these costs because we'll sell obviously lower units and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The thing is, you've got the T word, tax. Read my lips, no new taxes. Guess what? He didn't get reelected. So, I mean, you're totally right. The T word, you could say I have the cancer tax. If you pay this tax, we'll cure cancer. People would still say, but it's a tax. So yeah, you're absolutely right. You have that reality, that sort of negative reaction to taxing. All I can say is that the ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC models, at the end of the day, come out with a 2-3% charge for entities that perform music publicly. So that seems to be the area where it ends up with negotiation. For the Audio Home Recording Act, that was actually achieved as a result of litigation where you had the publishers and record companies suing the digital audio recording technology manufacturers. And so they ended up with a 2-3% levy as well. So that seems to be the area where contentious parties can agree that here's where it ends up. So I'm sort of, you know, bypassing all the analysis and sort of posturing and just saying, okay, let's say here's what it is, because that seems to be where it's historically been borne out. Mm-hmm. So I think if you have a 3% tax, once you get above 5%, I think you're really beginning to impact an enterprise's ability to be profitable. So my sense is that 3% is going to be where it would end up. So I'm just trying to sort of jump to the conclusion and put that into the research.
Thanks.
Maybe you don't want to call it a tax. I presume you're proposing that this is something that Congress would pass.
Would have to be, yes. Yeah.
But didn't we go down that route in the Betamax era when Disney wanted the same thing on VCR tapes and was not particularly successful?
Yes, and I think that, I wish that the private sector could come up with something that would approximate this. I'm wishing we had like an enlightened copyright despot or something who kind of come in and just implement this. I would prefer a private solution, because I think that, you know, when the government gets involved, it does tend to get mucked up and incredibly labyrinthine. But I think that the difference here is that it's not benefiting just a sector of the industry. It's not benefiting just, say, Hollywood or just the RIAA, but it's actually a regime that's implemented to open the floodgates for the sort of unbridled potential of the public using the internet. And so I think that the goal isn't to just funnel more money into the coffers of a arguably well-earning segment of the industry, but it's to fund this revenue pool to compensate artists. And so hopefully it's a bit of a different philosophy, but I acknowledge it's going to be a knockdown, drag out fight, and it may be utopian, and it may end up just sort of being, wouldn't that have been nice, you know, what were they thinking? But my hope is that we can just sort of say, look at the revenue, look what would have been earned, look what Metallica would have made, and just to point the possibility of this happening, because I think the private solution, as was shown by the webcasting debate, you know, where the RIAA wanted to make 50% of the money by webcasters, and ironically, you have the situation where the RIAA, where their member organizations, was spending huge amounts of money for independent radio promotion, and now you have this brand new technology where people are thriving to it, and what do the RIAA want to do? They want to get paid from it, and in so doing that, they, I think, in a way, sort of strangled this great potential new way of people hearing about songs and recordings in this understandable, although I would say, albeit short-sighted, attempt at getting paid. And I think you can look at getting paid in a lot of different ways, and if people are finding out about your artists or about your recordings and they're active, then you've achieved one of the golden rings, which is awareness, and people like this stuff. So it is going to be a knockdown, drag-out fight, and that's why I think that the Noank solution being rolled out in China first makes sense, because you have fewer jurisdictional hurdles in China. And so the idea of going to Chinese universities and having a one-stop payment and going to the government there, if the government says yes, then it happens. And so then you can take that there, and I think the model will work there. And then you go to Canada next, and again, if the model works there, it's a good idea, and you have less barriers. It's going to be a turf war. Especially when you're talking about taxes and people paying taxes and taxes on devices, and you're also wresting control away from private entities over the use of the creative works. So it's not, you know, but historically Congress has done this compulsory licensing before, and there is a historical precedent for this levy. So I do think that it could work, but I'm not naive enough to think that it's going to pass through Congress without any tug of war.
Rob Farris, I work here at the Berkman Center. What would you do with the incumbents in this model? I mean, it's a lot easier to envision a deal between the artists and the consumers without the incumbents involved.
Yep. Well, the incumbents still have catalog. And so the incumbents have their legacy recordings that will still be worthwhile. Really, I think, not to be callous about it, but You know, the horse and buggy was once upon a time, you know, an incumbent technology, and people made fun of, you know, where's your horse when the new cars came along? And I think that if you can't, you know, innovation, competition, I think is good as long as it's fair. And I think if you have a better vehicle, a better mechanism, better mousetrap, then I think you have to figure out another way and be entrepreneurial to survive it. I think that this would, I think, spell, it would be difficult for companies like, for instance, Snowcap or for Napster that have subscription models because there's no subscribing. So I think that they will, I think Apple might do just fine because they have the device that's elegant and easy to, and fun to play with. But I think in the end of the day, subscription models, I think, would be threatened by this. But I think that if it works better, and I think, you know, someday when we have a starport transporter, that'll spell the end of the airplane industry, you know, if that ever comes. And so be it. So I think it's just the nature of quality. And I think it's got to be about, I think it's going to be a meritocracy. You know, may the best idea and the best technology win.
If I might, Michael Jones, I'm a judge and I teach law as well. So here's my, because I guess I'm asking you, have you given up on the cultural model in terms of changing the culture of the users? Have you given up technology? Technology being, say, some sort of digital rights management. Here's my real world analogy, just to listening to you. Mothers Against Drunk Driving has done a lot to create awareness and focus on drivers, young drivers and older drivers about not to get behind the wheel impaired. Didn't take government agency to do it, and undoubtedly it's influenced behavior. Doesn't keep all drunk drivers off the road. Is there any hope to change the culture of the users, or is it genie out of the bottle, can't get the genie back in?
Well, I think it's genie out of the bottle. I think it's just so easy, and it's so fun, and it's a kind of a giddy feeling where people get where they can get anything they want to get for free. You can legislate. You can educate, but I don't know, like most of my students, when they saw P. Diddy and his, you know, bling talking about how fraud trading is hurting his career, they didn't have much sympathy for him. And so I think it's, and, you know, the RIAA always puts the face of the artist on their initiatives to try to make people feel like it's really hurting people. But I mean, you know, I think you can do both. You can educate, but I think that what was wrong when things were material isn't necessarily wrong when things are liberated from physical containers. And so if you can figure out a way to monetize it that compensates creators, then it wouldn't be wrong anymore. And so I think that it's not necessarily a wrong or right issue. I think it's wrong to take things that don't belong to you and not pay for it. But I think that this system, if it worked, would actually implement a system that would be based on compensation. And so but I think that the current methodology of trying to legislate ethics or trying to teach with a sledgehammer is not working. And so I think that they're trying to enshrine a snapshot of technology or control that I think, given what digital technology has done, it just doesn't make sense. It's like trying to force people to take a horse and buggy when they can take a plane. So I just think that in light of the incredible new opportunities, that there just needs to be, I think, a re-evaluation of ethics and a channeling of the potential. And so, but I think that there has been some, when I talk to my students, there has been some change in behavior, but I think statistically speaking, it's probably insignificant.
The number of new clients and servers that serve, you know, peer-to-peer networks or torrents or anything like that, and they're climbing. They're not going anywhere. So
yeah.
If you think of it that way in terms of the services.
Yeah, if I might interject, I've taught cyber law for about 6 or 7 years, and when I first started to teach it, literally every student acknowledged that it was a form of theft if they would do it, and now I don't have a one. 2 years ago, I had one, and he had been tagged by the Recording Industry Association of America, and he was the only one that got religion. And even despite his preaching, it didn't impact anybody else in the class. And I have two kids that are in their 20s, and I just say, please, you know, when they come knocking on the door.
Yeah, but it's just, you know, it's this notion of how can this be wrong? Yeah. It works so well. It's like toast on the toaster, bread in the toaster. How can this be wrong? It just does this. You know, no one got hurt. I wanted to hear the song, and I heard it right away. I mean, most of my students are like, you know, the entertainment industry just didn't get it. I mean, in their defense, you would have to have been omniscient or, you know, to get it and to understand what could have happened at the moment in time when Napster was first becoming popular. How could you possibly have looked ahead a decade or so and said, here are the new business models? I mean, nobody was that prescient. And so, but I remember talking to record label people who was, you know, one person in particular said, well, you know, we're going to sit on the sidelines and see how this internet thing plays out. Well, yeah, we'll see you later. You know, and because the boat's leaving. And so there are, there have to be new ways to figure out how people are going to get paid. This is not fair. For, you know, because some people say, well, the writers, you know, if a band gives away their music, you get their T-shirt, you come to their show. That's fine. But if they're doing cover songs by some woman who writes in Nashville, she's not getting paid from that. And so, you know, so I think there's got to be some kind of a way where people are going to be incentivized to write. I mean, if you're, it's hard enough to get paid when the payment structures are in place. I mean, in the old era when it was, you know, relatively stable, hardly anybody ever got a royalty check. You know, I mean, it's like an endangered species, you know, the royalty check. And so the idea of getting one of those, it's always been hard. And, you know, and the artistic psyche about, you know, if I'm so great, why am I flipping burgers? You know, it's always been hard. And so now it's even harder. And so this, you can't, I mean, even with the artistic drive to create, you can't, this kind of a system can't continue like this, because it's just going to eviscerate anybody's motivation to continue to create. It's not right.
I'm Sally Walkerman. I work here at the Berkman Center. I'm just wondering how a system like this could scale when we think about a global music industry.
Mm-hmm.
And international?
Well, that's a great question. I think that it would need to be sort of, you know, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, and hopefully if the U.S. can be a leader in this, then much of the rest of the world might agree. Although that said, you got, you know, whether it's levy or tax, no matter what language you're saying it in, people don't like it. There's resistance abroad from levying devices that's actually already in place in Europe. They have levies on devices to pay artists, and people don't like that there either. So I think it's, you know, it's going to have to be jurisdiction by jurisdiction. I don't think you're going to have one international company or transnational company that's collecting everything for everybody. But I think it is going to be. It may be naive. You know, it may be just, you know, wouldn't that be nice? But let's get back to planet Earth. You know, but I think that it's a sketch. That I think if I can see it, whether we can get all the constituencies to agree, and then whether, and the system has to be transparent, and it's got to work really, really well, and it's got to be kind of, you know, utterly reliable, and you've got to respect people's privacy and all those issues that are, you know, that are very thorny. But I think that as a broad brush proposal, I'd like to put it out there, and with some real statistics, because one of the things I think, I really admire the work of Noank. But I think one of the problems with that is that it's going to have people getting around it, and it's not, it's only funded by university fees and maybe fees by subscribers to certain devices. But I think what I'd like to do is have like a massive revenue pool generated by this iLevy. So really, I think you have a much more significant revenue pool would raise the stakes or raise the payments to the various artists that are involved. And I think if you have more a larger revenue pool, then it's just going to hopefully trickle down to the benefit of all artists, and people can actually get paid from what they're doing, instead of just using their recordings as a loss leader to get people in their tent.
So for a smaller question,
yeah,
just what if this passes in the U.S. and I want to download music from, say, a French artist that's copy, it's under some kind of EU copyright, French copyright.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have to pay? I mean, I've already paid.
Right. I guess in that situation, I mean, the files would the content would need to be contributed by the owners. And so hopefully this would only be the idea of a compulsory license would only be really effective in the U.S. And so it would not, I think, if it's governmentally mandated, we could have a WIPO sort of recommendation that would be adopted maybe by different countries as they see fit. But I think maybe WIPO would have to be a place to go with this kind of regime if it was implemented in one jurisdiction. But I think it would need to be, every country would need to be free to make its own determinations as to whether it's the catalog of its nationals would be contributed to this.
So that French artist probably wouldn't get paid?
Probably not. But
well, the question but is whether the French artist could opt into the system without bringing
right.
the whole country with
it. So that's so individually, yeah. maybe a catalog could opt in. You know, a French yeah. catalog owner could say, "I want to do that. I want to do this." So that would be a way to do that. So this, I'd like to, that's a great idea to break down barriers to inclusion. Maybe make it compulsory in the U.S., but if anybody abroad wants to opt in, then.
Otherwise, I'd say world music would get real popular really quick.
Right. Right. You had a question?
It's similar.
Okay.
Kind of makes it a tougher sell there. Are you going to have a tax that then pays French artists? I want to take that one up the hill myself.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the trans-jurisdictional issues.
Three times.
Yeah, I mean, even getting it to happen in the U.S. is going to be difficult. One of the responses of the industry that I've seen, I've been negotiating some major label deals now, you know, and there are essentially four ways that artists theoretically get paid. Recordings, merchandise, gigs, and publishing. And so traditionally, recording contracts are just about recordings. And they didn't touch merchandise, didn't touch gigs, didn't touch publishing. But now you're seeing more and more an attempt to wrap all these revenue streams up into a recording contract. And I, as a former major label recording artist who didn't get the love that I felt I deserved, the idea that I'm going to wrap up all my properties and give them to the man is not, I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not playing that game. And I think that there has to be, but I understand why the record labels could be incentivized by participation in these things, but not in an ownership sense. Like one of the things that I have talked about with one label is giving the label two exclusive merchandise items, but not exclusive merchandise rights across the board. So you allow the label to do two merch items per release, and they do a 50-50 split with that, and maybe have it in a separate account so it doesn't get cross-collateralized and with everything else. So if you do two merch items, a shirt that you can only get on the website or that the label makes available, you do a 50-50 split there with that. Or you maybe give the label a commission on the publishing for the placements of their recordings. So if the label is able to place a recording of their song that they on their recording into, say, a TV show, then you give the label a commission on the publishing side from that placement as well, because you know, obviously there's two permissions that are required to place a recording in a film, one from the owner of the copyright in the sound recording and one from the owner of the copyright in the song. So there are ways you can structure, I think, participation to incentivize a label to make an artist more, you know, to really push an artist and to make them more successful that wouldn't necessarily involve the label's owning those different rights. But I'd be really reluctant to give a label exclusive merchandising rights or a publishing component. But I think we have to sort of think about how this can work and what is going to be the way that it can work. And for a young band, giving away their recordings to sort of get people in their tent can make sense. But if you're a songwriter, like I say, in Nashville, you're not getting paid for that. And so, and it's, I think, you know, actually, you know, John Perry Barlow talked for a long time about, you know, wine without bottles. And I was surprised, actually, I saw him a year or so ago at an event here, and I thought he began changing his tune a little bit when it seemed like the Grateful Dead weren't playing as much anymore. And so now he wasn't going to be getting his performance royalties. And I was like, oh, you know, that's interesting, because now, you know, the once upon a time champion of Wine Without Bottles is, as it were, changing his tune. I wasn't sure if that was the case. But I think that you have to create a system that honors creativity and that lets people get paid. And just because people are going to your show and buying your band shirts if you're playing my song, that isn't really that's not participation. That's not meaningful participation for the songwriters. And so implementing something like this, you know, like the Napster or, you know, this idea of the collective licensing model with the iLevy is going to be, it may be pie in the sky. but I still think it does. It at least bears a study to put the numbers out there to say this is what could happen. And then even if the industry adopts it voluntarily somehow, I mean, I don't know how you could really adopt this voluntarily, because you'd have to fund the process. Maybe if people could do it like the NOANC model somehow. But I prefer the idea of a comprehensive sort of fee at the door to get into the system, because then people can trade and there's no incentive to hack around it.
Sort of right. You just mentioned funding. Where would the initial funding for this come from?
I mean, to start the whole thing up?
Yeah.
I guess...
Because I'm assuming you want to pay people royalties to begin with, and that would be a pretty much large sum of money. And since your tax base isn't established...
Well, I guess perhaps you could start the tax base. You could begin the tax base. I guess you'd have to have the whole system working before you could begin to sort of make people or have people participating. So maybe you'd have to do some pilot projects to see how it works. Maybe at universities first, just sort of see that the technology works, and maybe roll it out in stages. And so you maybe raise money by doing things at the universities in much the way that NOANC is doing or trying to do. And maybe even NOANC could be the entity that would monitor these payments. Who knows? I mean, I have no idea what the status of that is right now. But
and we do have Devon Copley, who is watching the webcast right now, and he works on the NOANC project. So he was saying if anybody did have questions about the model, we could ask him, and I could relay it over IRC.
Okay. I mean, one of the questions I have is how do you maintain the database of works, and how do you make sure that the allocations are being distributed to the stakeholders, and how do you ensure payment? And that just seems to me to be a massive project, is actually tagging the content owners and making sure that they're all getting paid. And you know, would this also involve union style? You know, you have secondary uses where feature performers are getting paid. And I mean, the database system, hopefully, if it's created once, either by NOANC or by anybody else, could be utilized for this. So you wouldn't have to create parallel databases. You could just have one comprehensive database. But I mean that this just a system of actually having the comprehensive database that would pay the publishers and the recording artists and the songwriters. That is a I'm not sure how far along NOANC is with that. Is NOANC in China? Are they just doing Chinese content, or is it any kind of American content?
Well, he says the works in the database right now is a big challenge, but it's a defined one, and that the comprehensive works database would be open data. I think I could probably have him call in and maybe talk to us, if that would probably be a little more conducive to the conversation. Mm-hmm. So you can just continue, and I'll just quickly get the phone code for him.
Yeah, I'm Rebecca Ness, and I'm an affiliate of the Berkman Center. My question's kind of along these lines. It seems to me that a lot of the music, at least pretty much all the music that I listen to these days, is mixes that are made by DJs where a lot of the stuff that's on the mix isn't by the particular DJ. Some of it might be, and most of the stuff is a collage of things that other artists have made. And it seems like from those artists, I mean, they just are not in a position to put that stuff into a database like this in the first place, because they haven't got a compulsory license system to allow them to pay reasonable prices for all of the samples that they're using. And I don't know, it just seems like it's already so difficult to imagine how a database like this works, but if your listening audience is already pulling from stuff that's never going to fit into the confines of what the IP owners are going to
do. I mean, you're talking, in a way, you know, the database that I'm envisioning is more like the factory database, mm-hmm. you know, not necessarily the participatory user base where people are doing mashups of their own, you know, maybe not from a quote-unquote official release. But I think, in a way, copyright law on many levels needs to be changed, I think. I would like to see some kind of a compulsory licensing system for samples.
I totally agree. That's
not
realistic.
No, but I mean, but it's... historically, the way that it's developed has... And sound recordings are treated totally differently than any other kinds of works are treated, and there's virtually no fair use for sound recordings at all, which is absurd. By a literal reading of Section 115, I believe, of the Copyright Act, that talks about the rights of sound recordings, it's, you know, if you're replicating the sound recording exactly, then you need permission, even if it's a de minimis use. I think that's absurd. I think it was an historical artifact because of the way that sound recordings came along as the runt of the copyright litter, where they didn't have anywhere near the same rights. So they got were actually especially the idea of recreating the actual fixation of sounds was emphasized strongly. But I think that there should be some kind of a compulsory license rate for sound recordings along the lines of a mechanical license rate. Maybe, if it's, 1 penny per second or a half penny per second, once you get to 2 seconds, you have to...
Welcome. You've reached...
Maybe there could be a short, compulsory license, but if it gets to be too long, then maybe you should get permission. I don't know. It's like... But trying to reconcile the notion...
We're the only participant in this conference.
...with the idea of creativity is... And frankly, I haven't gotten my head around at all around how to deal with mashups. I mean, I think they're, I love them. But trying to legislate how that's going to work. And also the notion of moral rights, where people, their work's being changed into something different. And what if you have somebody whose recordings were used in some, white supremacist rap song? You know what I mean? To paint a stark picture of that. And so here I am, a conscientious artist whose recordings are now, the backbeat for this song about hate. And what recourse do I have there? And do you abandon the idea of moral rights? Or how do you reconcile those rights? The idea of being able to prevent a work from being mutilated. And maybe it's irreconcilable. I don't know. But I think that what I'm suggesting is really more of a small rights model as published. And I think you're right. Maybe if the Copyright Office or there was some other place to go where you could add your work in, maybe as a part of the registration process, where you could, if your registration at the Copyright Office kicked you into the database. So that way, when you apply for your Form PA or your Form SR, you get a tag number that puts you into the system. So that may be a way for just regular creators who aren't factory commercially... traditional publishers could get a part of this, could be a part of the system.
Hello, this is Devin from NOAC. I'm online now. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Oh, cool.
So I was wondering, I had some questions about the content you're licensing in China. How much of that is American or at least, Western content?
Well, we're in sort of early... phases of licensing. We have deals in place with Chinese content only at the moment, but we've started some talks with Western content owners. The strategy is pretty much to get the Chinese content up and working and generating revenue for the content owners most likely first. I mean, ideally we get Western content before then, but we're sort of suspecting we're going to have to be able to show, that we're actually paying revenue to Chinese content owners before we're going to get a whole lot of buy-in.
And do you have any idea what the percentage of Chinese content is versus Western content and that system?
Well, Chinese consumers, well, it depends on the type of media you're talking about, but for pop music, they actually mostly focus on Chinese language music, so something like 80% of the market is... Taiwanese pop or Hong Kong pop or native, mainland China music. For movies, I think the proportion is pretty different. I think their Western movies are quite popular.
Mm-hmm. And how are you going about creating your database for the works? How are you registering the works?
Well, that's a good question. That's kind of, there's a lot of challenges involved with the technical implementation of the system. That's kind of my job, and so we're trying to figure out how to do it. We're in the specification phase right now for the works database. We've started building some of the other components, but the works database is a pretty big challenge.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And so, is it being recognized by like a sound wave, or how are you recommending doing that? I'm sort of befuddled by the idea of being able to track the content accurately.
Sure. Well, it's how much time have you got? I'll try and sum it up pretty quickly. The idea is that a content owner who is an entity that we know about, whether it's a large publisher or a small publisher, registers content with us. At the time of registration, they provide us metadata indicating, well, that there's this specific piece of media is owned by this specific entity. You know, the various rights that are relevant to it are owned by these entities. And then we get a copy of the file and then a fingerprint. We'll do a file hash on the actual digital file, and we'll also do a content fingerprint on the content. And then, you know, we collect usage data from out in the world, both through the access to the file across our distribution network and through, you know, client-side accounting mechanisms, which use the fingerprint algorithm on the client. And then we get, you know, reporting on usage from multiple sources, and sort of statistical analysis of the reporting gives us a proportional measure of use among the various pieces of the content.
Now, what about mashups? Is your fingerprinting technology able to sort of figure out combinations of files?
That's a good question. I think we have the legal approach to mashups worked out a fair bit more than we have the technological approach. I think from a fingerprinting perspective, typical audio fingerprints aren't necessarily going to recognize mashups. They won't recognize the constituent parts of a typical mashup because they pay attention to quite a lot of the song, and you know it's changed substantially typically in a mashup. So a mashup would register as a new piece of content from a fingerprinting perspective, but from the legal perspective, posed a structure which I think we are going to implement, which I think is a really interesting way to approach, is that we create an incentive at registration time for content for content owners to voluntarily license reuse. So basically, we pay them a higher royalty rate if they check the box at when they register the content saying, I voluntarily allow other NOINC system users to reuse this content for their own, you know, for mashups or such.
And are there any restrictions that anybody can put on that, or is it pretty much, you know, one check mark fits all subsequent uses?
That's a good question. I'd probably have to defer to Terry on that. My understanding is that there aren't really significant restrictions. The idea is if you want to restrict it, then don't check the box and right. Do one-off licenses, but we're not going to pay you as much for your content.
Right.
And Andres B. on the IRC chat also had a question that was sort of in a similar vein. He was asking, what do you think the royalty discrepancy between the Section 115's $9.10 and the free market 70 cents approach is to sound recordings, and do you feel this is fair?
Can you repeat that again?
He said, what do you think the royalty discrepancy between Section 115's $9.10 and the free market 70 cents approach to sound recordings? Approach to sound recordings, and do you feel if that's unfair, like the discrepancy?
Well, I think it should be a percentage in the end, because I think if you have it as a penny rate, it's going to be, you're going to run headlong into different sort of licensing models. Like the European model for mechanicals is like it's a percentage of the price paid to the distributor, and I think that makes more sense than having it be a penny rate per file. If you can talk about it as a percentage, then it can sort of travel through different mechanisms more readily. And the 9.1 cents just refers to the composition as compared to the 70 cents or so for the recording. I think that the record companies are just trying to make up for lost time, having never really had a performance royalty for their, you know, for their works. And so, and I think it's understandable that they want to get paid more, but I think ultimately, if it was a percentage-based model, and maybe sharing the revenue equally between publishers. And so I don't see necessarily any reason why a publisher should make less or more than the owner of a sound recording. But that's just a personal observation. Great. Any other?
If anybody else has questions?
Yeah.
Is this, do you see this model working for digital downloads of movies and even of TV, which is ending up a lot?
Yeah, I don't see why it should discriminate against different kinds of content. I think it could all work. I think that obviously movies might need to participate in a higher, you know, might need to, you know, you make more per movie than you would per a song. It's, you know, the costs associated with a movie are significantly greater than the costs associated with making a sound recording. So I think, but the royalty rate, I think, it could. I mean, this could apply to all kinds of content. It could be digital. It could be, you know, visual files, audiovisual works. I don't see that. I think it could be any kind of content as long as people voluntarily can contribute to the system.
And then once someone has access to a file through the system, they can do whatever they want with it, theoretically.
Yeah, well, the idea would be that if every device is compliant and can track performances and transfers, then yeah, watch it again. You watch it again, there's a micropayment that happens under the hood, and you're not paying more for it per se, but every time you watch it, it's ticking off another participation in the royalty pool, again, with the caveat that you don't want to have somebody, you know, auto-pinging their song forever. I mean, I guess, I don't know how you would, I'm going to go to bed tonight, I'm going to repeat my song 50,000 times when I get up in the morning, and I love that song. So I mean, I think there's got to be some kind of a, and again, what's NOANC doing about that? Is there any sort of, how are you guys dealing with the false popularity corruption possibility?
Sure, gaming is the word that we use to refer to that challenge.
Yep.
And Terry and Paul actually come up with what I think is a rather ingenious, not a total solution, but an approach that really minimizes the risk of it. And that is, essentially, if you think of each user as having an equal number of votes for the pool, so we're not really counting how many individual uses a given licensee, a user, makes of any of various pieces of content, but rather the proportion of their usage in a given time period. So if you think of it as everybody gets 10 votes per day, and if they only listen to one song, then one song gets all 10 votes. But if they listen to 10 songs, then each of those 10 songs gets one vote. Hmm. And what it means is that an individual can't tilt the pool by using a lot or downloading a lot or doing anything, you know, gaming in that way, only get 10 votes no matter what.
But you could, though, send it to all your pals.
Sure, you could. Absolutely. And if your pals like it, then they're going to listen to it, and then the artist should get paid for that.
Mm-hmm. But you think there's a kind of a built-in upper limit as to how far that can go by this sort of 10 votes per day methodology?
Right, right. Now, there definitely is a danger of a more sophisticated kind of attack, which would involve a botnet, where someone would, install illicit software on multiple machines and simulate usage on multiple machines. And that's probably the attack that I'm worrying most about right now and trying to figure out ways to stop.
Right. Yeah, because I think that's going to be the abuse of a system if this is implemented, just the idea of that, you know, the gaming to create apparent popularity.
Sure, but in the end, the gaming has a beneficiary who is somebody who is a registered entity in the system. It's a publisher. So if we, through statistical analysis, can identify, persistent gaming on behalf of a given publisher, well, we can punish that publisher.
Mm-hmm. You can publish their mugshot on the web.
Or stop paying them.
Yeah, okay. There you go. That'll work.
Does this kind of system, following on Alex's question about the, you know, not discriminating between different types of media, or different kinds of content, rather, does that raise an issue, though, with the 2-3% pool for the levy, that the recording industry could say, hey, we got 2-3% all to ourselves under the Audio Home Recording Act, and the movie people come in, you know, therefore that pool needs to be bigger?
Well, I think probably what I would do is allocate the consumption, maybe say that, you know, compare the consumption levels of movies overall compared to the consumption levels of music, and sort of say, okay, that 2/3 of the pool would be to music and 1/3 of the pool would be to movies, whether it's, you know, based on the number of statistical times that a movie is, you know, that all movies are consumed in a year versus all recordings are consumed in a year. If you have a ratio, then I think you just allocate whatever the appropriate percentage is to the various content types. But I wouldn't want to raise the revenue pool because I think that I think once you get beyond that 3%, it just becomes too big of a bite, I think, to maintain sort of viability, commercial viability for the, you know, for the different devices and media that are being taxed. So how much money is being raised by Noank right now? What's the pool of revenue being raised from the Chinese participation in the system?
Well, none right now. We're not in operation, but our first pilot launch will be in the fall, and we're in the process of working out exactly how many people are going to be participating and what the revenue per person will be. So I don't know that I'm really at liberty to say, but we are likely to have, I'd say, hundreds of thousands of participants in the initial phase. And I really don't know what the per user revenue would be. So I'm afraid I can't say.
Any other questions? Comments?
If not, then thank you for coming by. It was a
sure.
great talk.
Thank you. Stay tuned.